Do you ever think about all that goes into getting the food and drink on your table before you even start shopping? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In New York, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Thursday, November 25th. Good to have you with us. What is or was on your Thanksgiving table today, if you observe, that is? Some turkey and stuffing? I hope some pumpkin pie. Save some for me, please. And perhaps there's a bottle or two? Well, be thankful for that last one. I mean the vessel itself, because there's a shortage of the glass bottles we use for liquor and wine. Blame the by now familiar culprits. Log jams at the ports, not enough truckers, higher costs. Marketplace's Matt Levin has more on how that might affect the alcohol industry's most lucrative time of the year.
Look closely and you'll see the gin, vodka, and rum from St. Augustine Distillery comes in very specific glass bottles.
Our traditional bottle also has a little bit of taper, which means it's wider at the shoulders than it is at the foot.
Mike Diaz is the co-founder of the Florida-based distillery. He says for spirits competing on the same shelf, marketing takes more than a clever name and cool label.
That bottle shape, the type of cap, they're all critical components that contribute to the overall brand.
Take gin. It's why squat, green-tinted Tanqueray looks so different from upright, transparent Beefeater. So Diaz can't just switch to a more generic bottle while his are stuck on a container ship. He's paying about 20% more for those, costs he says customers will notice. And while messed up logistics are certainly to blame, Scott DeFife with the Glass Packaging Institute says there's another culprit.
The demand was incredible because of the switch from on-premise dining to consumption at home.
You might think the wine industry would have it easier. Those bottles all kind of look the same. Actually, no, says Matthew Meckel with the Napa Wine Company.
If you're going to make really nice Cabernet Sauvignon and you're going to try to sell it for several hundred dollars a bottle, it's going to dictate that you're going to put it in a very nice bottle.
Even though cheaper glass won't impact the tannins or anything.
If you were to give a layperson the Pepsi challenge, so to speak, if you put a cheaper, less common bottle in front of them versus the other bottle, doesn't affect the taste of the wine.
And hey, personal pro tip, if you run out of glasses, wine from the gravy boat ain't so bad. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
Thanks, Matt. Wall Street was closed for the Thanksgiving holiday, so I'm sure we'll come up with something when we do the numbers. This year, Fred turned 30. I'm not talking about a person, though you might call it a good friend to economists and economics reporters. Fred stands for Federal Reserve Economic Data. It's housed at the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis. And with 800,000 data series from more than 100 different sources, it's become pretty essential to how we understand the economy and how it changes over time. Iveta Fortova is the manager of FRED and also known as its data champion.
We can take the data from multiple sources, put them all on our website so users can go and, you know, see what the latest unemployment rate looks like or what is inflation doing nowadays.
The unemployment rate was 4.6% in October, by the way, and the Fed's preferred inflation gauge, PCE, was up 5% from last year. Beyond the headline stuff, though, I asked Iveta about some of the more out-of-the-way data you might find on the site.
On the historical side, for example, we have a really neat data set from the National Bureau of Economic Research. And it's a data set with historical macroeconomics data. But really, you know, the term macroeconomics, it can be intimidating to people. But there are some really exciting series, such as shipments of kitchen sinks and lavatories to the United States in the times of the industrialization period. There was a peak around the 1920s when a lot of people in the U.S. were in need of toilets. And to a greater good, they also thought about a sink. So those two data series are highly correlated.
Okay, I'm totally looking that up. What do you wish you had more data on?
Oh, wow. How much how much wishes can I have?
Let's give you three wishes. We'll go with the classic.
I would probably like to see data looking into future, so projection data. And another type of data that I would be interested in is more regional data. In FRED, our smallest unit of region is county, but really going down to all the way to zip code or census tract, I think would be really neat. Probably last but not least, it would be interesting to also look into institutional level data. So it's just not like an aggregate of some sort, but it can be particular data on like sales in specific stores or information about that. So I'm more on a socioeconomic side of things.
So what do you know about your users besides the usual suspects, economists and researchers and journalists like me? Are regular folks turning to FRED or should they be for some of the economic decisions in their lives?
Yes, definitely. We welcome everybody. And I think that is also our everyday struggle, is that our product is visited by so many users with so many sophistication levels that sometimes, you know, developing our products to the next level makes it somewhat of a challenge. We really welcome our users from educational sector, academia, particularly students. Sometimes they even email us to see if we will be able to answer homework for them. But we see our student users as kind of an investment into future, because once these users are out of college and, you know, they're looking into buying a house and getting a quote for a mortgage, for example, you know, they can go on FRED and see what is the average a mortgage rate, and then they can kind of assess, well, you know, how well are they doing compared to the typical mortgage rates. So we have a wealth of data that I believe can make our users better in making better decisions in their lives.
Iveta Fortova is the data champion at FRED, at the St. Louis Fed. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
About that kitchen sink thing Iveta mentioned, I did look it up, and there were 157,800 kitchen sinks shipped to the U.S. in March 1924, and it was downhill until that particular data set ends in 1931. There's data, and then there's real life. And that's why we have our series, My Economy. In today's installment, we hear from one engineer hoping to make her industry more inclusive for Muslim women.
I'm Amina Shafiq, and I'm a senior water quality advisor for a company called Severn Trent Water, based in the Midlands region of the UK. When I joined Severn Trent, I was so welcomed here. But just because I feel like I fit in doesn't mean that I'm not still a minority. So in my team, I'm the only one who wears a headscarf, and I'm the only Muslim in the team. So I think that's what made me think initially, like, if I was to pursue a career in engineering, going out to site and doing that manual sort of operational work, how far can I get? In the last few months, I've been working on a side project to my day-to-day job, which has involved me designing and rolling out a PPE-specific headscarf. So that idea initially came around because when I was out on site, I was finding that I was adjusting my PPE. So normally we have like a high-vis jacket, a helmet, some safety boots, gloves, and safety specs My normal style of headscarf has quite a lot of loose material when I wrap it around my head. And it also means that the helmet doesn't fit as snug. So I took inspiration from like an athletic headscarf that had more of a snug fit. And I kind of took that idea forward to people higher up in the company. And then it was rolled out and put into the catalog. And we now have a PPE headscarf. It's gotten a lot of recognition from other water companies, other engineering industries, and I hope it positively affects people's thinking, especially Muslim women who may have wanted to pursue an operational role but probably felt like they couldn't because the industry is not for them. Just because you follow a certain religion doesn't mean that your safety should be compromised. So that's the message that I want to send out.
That was Amina Shafiq. And thanks to our friends over at the BBC for that story. By the way, here in the U.S., according to the census, as of 2019, women held just 15% of engineering jobs. We want to know what's going on in your economy. You can let us know at marketplace.org/myeconomy. Coming up,
we're talking about areas that have much smaller economies.
And that's part of the appeal. But first, let's do the numbers. Markets in the U.S. are closed today for the Thanksgiving holiday. In Europe, it's business as usual. Britain's FTSE rose 0.3%. France's CAC 40 was up 0.4%. And Germany's DAX found 0.2%. If you're on the road today, a gallon of regular gas will set you back an average of $3.39, according to AAA. The Energy Information Administration reports that the price of a gallon of regular has stabilized this week, thanks to a tight gas supply and strong demand. Drive safely, everybody. There are many divisions in our country these days, including apparently Americans' preferred kind of cranberry sauce, fresh or canned. This year, Axios studied Instacart data from 2020 and found that on average, 24 states tended to order canned cranberry sauce, while 26 states went for fresh. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. Americans are traveling again for this holiday. The Transportation Security Administration estimated 20 million travelers would come through airport checkpoints over the four-day weekend, roughly double the number last year. Yesterday alone, more than 2.3 million people went through airport security. And that's just a few hundred thousand shy of the traffic on the day before Thanksgiving in 2019, before COVID changed everything. But if this kind of leisure travel is coming back, it's another story for business and international trips. From Portland, Oregon, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has more.
Portland International Airport was busy on Tuesday night as I picked up my daughter flying home from college. Most of these people were domestic travelers visiting family or on vacation. International travel is still down by about 40%, and business travel is down by half, says Colin Scarola at CFRA Research.
The things holding back international and business, a lot of offices are still closed. A lot of businesses are enjoying the savings of a reduced travel budget.
The pandemic has altered the way business is done, says Madhu Unakrishnan at Airline Weekly.
The investment banker who bought a last-minute business fare for a lunch meeting in London, that's probably gone forever. And meetings that can be done over video conferencing probably will not go back to in-person meetings anytime soon.
Unakrishnan says small and mid-sized businesses are starting to send people out again to meet customers. And while airlines are still hurting without corporate clients buying the most expensive seats on the plane, he says non-business travelers are picking up some of the slack.
There is a trend towards premium leisure, as it's called. People who have been stuck at home during the pandemic have a lot of savings and more discretionary income and are upgrading themselves to business class seats and premium seats for vacations and to visit friends and family.
One important segment of corporate travel that hasn't recovered yet is conventions and trade shows. These events can take a year or more to plan, says Chip Rogers at the American Hotel and Lodging Association.
We believe that by 2023, early 2024, we'll be back to 100%. So we see the planning at these large convention centers picking up.
That pickup matters most to big urban hotels with lots of meeting and banquet space and lots of workers in their bars and restaurants. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
This next story is going to sound awfully familiar, just with different scenery, because the United States is not the only country with a housing shortage. Australia is also facing what some are calling an affordability crisis as home prices rise faster than incomes. It's getting so extreme in some places that many young Australians face a stark choice: either move hundreds, even thousands of miles away to find somewhere they can afford, or stay and keep paying ever more expensive rent. The BBC's Frey Lindsay reports.
Here we are. Let's go inside.
This is Alison. She's in her early 30s and she's from Sydney. But she's giving us a virtual tour of the house she just purchased in central Japan. Alison works as a teacher at a local university, and she was already living in Japan when COVID struck. Faced with the prospect of not being able to return to Australia for some time, as well as property prices back home, she decided to make her stay in Japan permanent.
Seeing the price jump with the pandemic hitting Australia, the prices just got unbelievable. And, the price of a Japanese property is the price of a car in Australia. The real painful element of this story is that my parents know that my siblings and I won't ever be able to afford to live in a house near them. And even, honestly, to just afford rent in those postcodes is becoming further and further away from a reality.
In some ways, this is an old story. Australian housing prices have taken off in the last 10 or 15 years. But since the beginning of the pandemic, things have intensified dramatically. Mike Wood is editor of Australian Broker, the country's leading mortgages news site.
There's very low interest rates, historically low, which means that people can get loans very easily. There has been pent-up demand, which has come from people obviously not spending money during the pandemic. And then you also have a chronic lack of supply, especially in cities like Sydney and Melbourne.
Okay, so give us some numbers here. How much have prices been going up during the pandemic?
In all of Australia, prices have gone up 6%, right? Which doesn't sound that much. But in Sydney, it's 19%. And in parts of Sydney, say the Northern Beaches, it's gone up $7,300 a week. Obviously, if the price is rising 20% a year, the goalposts continually move further and further away.
And that's the reality for a lot of people who grew up in Australia's big cities. Even if they can save something for a deposit, they just can't save fast enough to keep up. That's exactly the case for Susan. Like Alison, she is in her 30s and grew up in Sydney. She and her partner are seriously considering moving to Adelaide, a city 800 miles from where she grew up.
It just feels as though you're kind of fighting a losing battle. Then you do kind of have a look at what you would be able to afford to purchase in, you know, other cities. My family are all in Sydney, so it's a really difficult decision.
But will the government do anything to help people like Susan? Saul Eslake, the founder of Carina Economic Advisory, says they're reluctant. That's because the millions of older Australians who already own at least one home make up a sizable chunk of their voter base.
Governments at the state and local level have made it increasingly difficult to redevelop existing housing in urban areas at higher densities in order to avoid offending neighbours. This is often referred to as NIMBY policies, not in my backyard. We have dug ourselves into a hole in terms of housing affordability and home ownership. And a profound piece of wisdom is that when you're in a hole, the first thing to do is to stop digging.
But with serious reform to the housing market missing from the platforms of both major political parties, it seems Australia has some digging yet to go. I'm the BBC's Frey Lindsay for Marketplace.
If you're still working from home, like me, most of the time, you might have thought about where else you might be able to do that. I mean, if you can work from anywhere, then couldn't you also live anywhere? Some towns around the country are trying to capitalize on that newfound freedom by offering cash to people who relocate and bring their jobs with them. Minnesota Public Radio's Dan Crocker has that story.
Last year, like many Americans, Matt Farrenbrook found himself suddenly doing his job from home. He lived in Topeka, Kansas, where he worked for the state government. But he and his wife had often thought about moving back to the upper Midwest, where he went to college.
And it was just a question of, how are we going to end up back up here? Because we both have professional degrees. You know, we're talking about areas that have much smaller economies.
Earlier this year, they saw a good job for her as an urban planner with the city of Bemidji, population 15,000 in far northern Minnesota. And then he read about a program that offers $2,500 to telecommuters who move there. So he pitched the idea to his boss. He could telecommute for his job, working as an auditor for the Kansas legislature from Bemidji, Minnesota.
And they're like, all right, let's try this. We want to keep you, we want to retain our talent. Let's try this out as a pilot program.
So the Farrenbrooks moved in July, and after a three-month tryout, his job is now permanent. They are one of more than two dozen families who have qualified so far for the program. It's one of several around the country, from northern Arkansas to West Virginia, where communities are paying people to move there. Many of them are rural areas that tout their slower pace of life, easy access to the outdoors, and often cheaper housing. Ben Winchester researches rural migration at the University of Minnesota. He says with fewer people tethered to big city offices, more people are moving in search of what he calls a life-work balance.
And I say it that way because I think we have shifted away from a work-life balance to a life-work balance.
That's a big part of Bemidji's pitch to newcomers. It's always been a place for people to vacation at a resort or a cabin on a lake in the North Woods. Dave Hengel, executive director of Greater Bemidji, says the area also offers an all-fiber, high-speed broadband network, something that even some big cities don't have.
The opportunity is there now for them to stay here if they choose to change their lifestyle. And I think we are in a unique time right now for that message to resonate.
For towns like Bemidji, new residents contribute to the tax base, but they also add talent to the local workforce, kids to the schools, and volunteers to the broader community. As rural communities roll out their welcome mats, though, a key challenge they face is to be welcoming to newcomers in places where locals are sometimes resistant to change. Sarah Sanchez moved from Phoenix to Bemidji in the middle of winter and in the middle of the pandemic.
It was very difficult because everything's closed. How do you get connected with community when everyone's social distancing?
Sanchez is working remotely as a grant manager for a Phoenix nonprofit. Her husband is now a youth director at a local church here. She left a lot of relatives back in Arizona, but the Bemidji program connected them with a local family with similar interests. And Sanchez says they hit it off.
And for me, that was really like the part where I felt like, man, like there are people out here that I really connect with and that I have a lot in common with. And, you know, I can really see myself, you know, establishing some more roots here and building relationships.
Attracting and retaining newcomers like Sanchez is especially important for rural communities that have an aging population and lose younger people every year to school and jobs in larger cities. In Bemidji, Minnesota, I'm Dan Crocker for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, how about some more fun with Fred? In a blog post, analysts at the Fed Data Hub did a price matchup between turkey and soy-based tofurkey using numbers from the Department of Agriculture and the International Monetary Fund. The winner? Tofurkey. On price alone, a serving costs just 66 cents. A comparable helping of turkey came in at $1.42. As for overall value, depends on your values, right? That's it. We've got to go. But first, your moment of economic context for this Thanksgiving. Solidarity with all those working today. But more and more retail workers are getting the day off. We told you earlier this week about Target deciding to stop opening stores on Thanksgiving permanently. MarketWatch had a list of other big companies that kept stores closed today, including Apple, Costco, Home Depot, and IKEA. On a very much related note, Adobe predicts online shopping today will hit a new record. Amir Babawi, John Buckley, Eve Epstein, John Gordon, Rick Carr, and Diantha Parker are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Amy Scott. We will see you tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.